So, I've been thinking, what if F1 engines had no rules? How powerful would they really be? I'm talking about no rules on the configuration. So you could have an inline 4, a V12, or even a W24. Why not? And no rules on capacity. So is it better to go for a 2-litre that's small and light, or a massive 10-litre that's powerful and heavy? And would you bother using a hybrid system? Yes, an electric motor adds a lot of torque, but the batteries are still pretty heavy and cumbersome. And that's all weight you still need to brake, turn, and accelerate around a circuit. So, if the goal is to get an F1 car around the circuit as quick as possible, what would designers actually do? Well, I spoke with the Red Bull Powertrain's performance design team leader to find out what he'd get up to. But there must be some rules, otherwise we might end up with a rocket strapped to the rear wing. So, let's say that our no rules engine must be able to fit in a 100 by 60 by 60 centimeter space. That's 39 by 24 by 24 inches. Which, by the way, is a huge volume and way bigger than F1's current engines. For example, an old V10 from the 2000s would be about 62 centimeters long, 56 centimeters wide, and 42 centimeters tall. And, of course, we can't go too big. The Adrian Newey's of this world will already be complaining that the engine is getting in the way of their beautiful aerodynamics. Beyond the size and the fact it can't be a rocket, in terms of rules, I don't think there's much else we need to cover. It can have a turbo, it can be any configuration, it can be whatever capacity you can fit in our space, and it can use a hybrid system. Oh, and it can use any core materials that currently exist. Now, F1 has seen some crazy engines in the past, so let's first look back to see what insane designs engineers have come up with, and hopefully get some inspiration. Just take a look at this Lotus from 1968. First, it's a bit of a weird shape for a race car. It's kind of like a wedge. But look closer, particularly at the rear of the car, and you'll see that it's even stranger. Cars from the late 60s normally have exhaust coming out of the rear, like this beautiful Ferrari. But this Lotus doesn't have any, and instead has a large exhaust or something coming out of the top, just behind the driver. And that's because under the bodywork is a Pratt & Whitney turbine engine. It compresses incoming air, combines it with fuel, ignites it, and uses the high pressure gases to spin a turbine, which drives the car's gearbox and then the wheels. It's basically a jet engine adapted for a race car. And this thing is wild. What on earth were the designers thinking? Well, they were thinking they were onto something. The car and engine competed in 6 F1 races, but only finished once. So it'd be easy to write it off as a stupid experiment, but this type of propulsion did have some success. This is the STP Paxton Turbo car, and it's what inspired the Lotus. I mean, it almost won the 1967 Indy 500, where it led the race for 171 laps. However, it had a mechanical failure with only 9 laps to go. It came so close to winning with a gas turbine engine. Okay, so turbine engines seem like a decent choice, but let's head back to a combustion engine with this flat 12 design. Just listen to this. That's not the kind of noise you want to hear when testing a new engine. It sounds like a bag of spanners. It did get going though, but it still didn't sound great. We just made a video about why V10s are scientifically proven to make us happy, and this sound definitely wasn't included. It's the Subaru 1235 from the 1980s, and just look at how complicated it is. Subaru were trying to become an F1 engine manufacturer and partnered up with Motori Minardi to create this 3.5-litre flat 12. And apart from being massively underpowered, it also required cooling from the top of the side pods, rather than the typical airbox in the roll hoop, meaning that the Coloni car that the engine sat in had to have these weird air ducts, ruining the car's aerodynamics. The package was incredibly slow, and at one race they were 17 seconds off pole position, meaning that they got cut off at the pre-qualifying stage, which was a thing back in the 80s when there were too many cars for the grid. Anyway, the Coloni team dropped the engine after only 8 races, and Subaru had never tried to return. So, flat 12s might be out of the picture. But to be fair, Subaru engines aren't known for reliability. But how about a W12? Look at this, the Life W12. It has a naturally aspirated 12-cylinder engine, so there's three banks of four cylinders. Just look at the W shape and the unusual exhaust configuration. Now, of course, we have W configurations in cars like the Bugatti Veyron, and while they work well in a modern road car, they didn't work in F1 in 1990. The engine produced only 400 horsepower when the same capacity V configurations were hitting 700, and it had reliability problems as well. The chassis was also pretty terrible, initially failing to pass the FIA's crash test, and the car never qualified for an F1 race, as it was always too slow. Okay, so I know these examples aren't going too well, but I love how engineers are trying different things, and perhaps they were just ahead of their time. Our No Rules engine could learn from their mistakes. So it's time for some innovation from Ferrari. This is the Ferrari V6 Comprex. It was an experimental engine developed and tested in 1981. The engine was a V6 configuration and used a unique form of forced induction known as a Comprex mechanical monocharger. Now, that's a lot of words, and to be honest, it is pretty complicated. But the idea was to get rid of turbo lag, which is a nightmare for drivers. You hit the accelerator pedal when you want to accelerate, but not much happens. And only then, after a while, the power comes in, and usually all of a sudden. This causes the car to get wheel spin and makes it hard for the driver to drive on the limit. However, the Comprex mechanical monocharger would transfer pressure from the engine's exhaust gases to its intake air at the speed of sound. It meant that the driver didn't have to deal with the traditional turbo's lag, and the power wasn't drawn directly from the engine like with a supercharger. It was the best of both worlds. However, as with many of these innovations, it was just too fragile, and it also affected aerodynamics and cooling as well. So it was dropped from this car, and Ferrari used a twin turbo instead. Okay, so enough with the history. How are we going to get as much horsepower from our No Rules engine as possible? Well, there are five areas we're going to cover. What configuration do we choose? Do we want to use a turbo or even a supercharger? And are we going to use some kind of battery and motor hybrid system? What kind of exotic materials are going to be the best? And what kind of RPM and horsepower can we really expect? Okay, so F1 engineers have really played with engine configurations over the years, from two-cylinder V-twins in the 50s to 16 cylinders also in the 50s and in the 60s. These 16-cylinder monsters were made by BRM, British Racing Motors, a race team that competed in F1 from the 1950s to the 1970s, and a team that won the World Championship in 1962 with Graham Hill. And they really pushed things with engine design as well. They produced a V16 in the early 50s with the BRM Type 15, and then a 3-litre H16 engine in the mid-60s, an engine that we've spoken about a few times on this channel. These engines were wild, and I love the fact that the rules were wide open and that engineers explored such varied routes to getting a car around a track as fast as possible. But what's best for our No Rules engine? And if we have the space, why not just go for a V24? There are obviously a ton of configuration options. We could go with a single cylinder, an inline, a V, or any of the more unusual options, a W, an H, or even a U. So first, let's write off a single cylinder engine. With just one piston, it will have fewer power strokes and it wouldn't be balanced. And as it's a single piston, to have any kind of displacement, it would need to be huge, which in turn means it would be very heavy. And a big heavy piston moving up and down means a high reciprocating mass. So it would either have to run at low RPM or risk exploding. However, it would be simple with fewer moving parts, but we need more power, baby. So what about an inline? A typical choice here would be an inline 4 or 6. A Mercedes even ran an inline 8 in the mid-1950s, which won the World Championship in 1954 and 55. Inlines are great as they're still really simple. And remember, we need reliability. And the most powerful engine in Formula 1 ever was in fact an inline, a BMW 1.5-litre turbo from 1982. And just look at it. I love that colour scheme, but it also had a reported 1,350 horsepower, which must have been wild in a 1980s F1 car. But the real issue with bigger inline engines is the packaging. If you want to add more power with more cylinders, it's going to take up quite a lot of space. And if you went for 8 cylinders in a row, that's a lot of room. And also, the engines tend to be quite tall, so Mr. Nui would not be happy with us. The crankshaft would also need to be pretty long, and the longer it is, the more likely it is to bend. So we want more cylinders in order to save some piston weight, but we need to save some space. So let's take the pistons and position them horizontally, moving away from each other. What a good idea. Flat engines are basically a V configuration squashed down with an angle of 180 degrees. So that means, in terms of the space that they take up, they're pretty good. Not too long thanks to cylinders on both sides, and not too tall thanks to the horizontal layout. However, they are quite wide. So it's good for a lower center of gravity, but bad for aero, as there's less room for Nui to do what he wants with the back of the car. Just look at this Brabham BT45 from 1977 that had a flat 12, and you'll see what I mean. The engine cover is super low. But flat engines aren't perfect either, and we can do better. So, how about a W configuration? Well, before I get into Bugatti's favourite configuration, I need to tell you about today's sponsor, Brilliant.org. If you'd like to learn more about some of the topics covered in this video, including maths, data analysis, programming, and AI lessons, then you should check out Brilliant. Brilliant has thousands of interactive lessons where you learn by doing, and this learning method is 6 times more effective than just watching lecture videos. Their Predicting with Probability course shows you how to start building a foundation in data science. There's no doubt that data skills are necessary for navigating this modern world, and Brilliant is the best way to get them. And learning a small amount each day is so important for your growth. So if you'd like to try everything that Brilliant offers for a full 30 days for free, then visit brilliant.org/driver61 to start your free trial today, or scan the QR code on screen. You'll also get 20% off an annual premium subscription. So what about these W configurations? After all, Bugatti Veyrons and Chirons use them, and they're capable of 270 and 300 miles per hour respectively. Well, this is a block from a Bugatti W16. As you can see, it's basically a V configuration, but the length of the block has been reduced, meaning that the cylinders need to come up alongside each other, forming 2 wider banks. But it's worth noting that the Bugatti W configuration is a different take on the W that we saw with Life's W12 from earlier. As you can see here, the Bugatti engine only has 2 banks, but the Life W12 has 3, which, in my mind at least, is a true W configuration. And again, aside from the complexity, the packaging is a problem with the W. The 3 banks and all the exhaust just take up too much space, which would damage the aerodynamic design of the car. Now, there are a couple of other feasible configurations: U, VR, opposed, rotary, radial, horizontal, K, and X, but they really don't stand a chance on our no-rules car. So it looks like we'll have to return to the old favourite, the trusty V configuration. It's been the most common configuration in F1 and other motorsports over the decades, and there's good reason for it. Take a look at this. The V configuration is a great balance between length, width, and height. You can squeeze in a good number of cylinders in the space and keep the weight down reasonably low. And for F1 in particular, there's a good amount of space around the bottom of the engine, meaning that the rear of the car can taper away, which is good for aerodynamics and our mate Adrian. In F1, we've seen all types of V configuration: V2, V4, V6, which we have at the moment, V8, V10, V12, and V16. Someone just needs to try a V14, and we've got a full set. But how many cylinders is best if we don't have any rules? Well, the first thing to note is that we're not limited on displacement. We can get plenty of fuel into our engine. So if we want to use all of that fuel but only have a V2, V4, or V6 to play with, the pistons are going to have to be massive. In turn, that means that the engine will be bigger, but more importantly, the reciprocating mass, the weight of the piston moving back and forward, will be huge. And with all the extra mass, the engine's parts are more likely to break. So we'll either have an engine that's unreliable or one that needs to run really low RPM to keep the reciprocating mass down and the parts where they should be. So to keep the piston's weight down and to keep the same number of litres, we need more pistons. More pistons with the same displacement means lighter pistons and an engine that can rev higher. And good news, that means we're talking V10s, V12s or V16s. However, from the engine expert that we spoke to, a V12 seems to be the best balance. This is Micah McMahon, who formerly worked at Red Bull Powertrains, and he loves V12s. Good man.
With the V12 is you have plenty of space for a large bore. For the given power we're going to have, you don't have to turn obsessive RPMs, nothing wild. It'd be a relatively low strung engine. At a meter long with the V12, you're still talking like, you'd probably be out like 102, 104 millimeter bore. I mean, it's a big piston.
And not turning a crazy RPM is important for the previous reasons, keeping the reciprocating mass down and the engine unexploded. But it's not just about the pistons. If an engine has a traditional overhead cam, valves can become an issue too. Valves manage the air and the fuel into and the exhaust gases out of the combustion chamber. Intake valves open to allow a precise mixture of air and fuel into the cylinder, while exhaust valves open to remove the resulting gases after the combustion. But before the valves open, the camshaft turns and its lobe hits the valve, before it's closed by a spring. But at higher RPMs, the camshaft turns faster, and the valve is hit harder, which increases inertia. And so, if the valve isn't strong enough to overcome the inertia, there's going to be a delay in closing the valve. And if the valve closure is incomplete or delayed, that's not good. And we call it valve float. It means that some of the power is lost, and at worst, it means that the valve is still open as the piston comes to the top of its stroke, where it hits the valve and causes serious damage. And in order to make F1 engines rev higher, this needed fixing. So in the late 80s, Renault introduced the first pneumatic valves engine into F1. However, it wasn't until the 1990s that the other F1 teams began to adopt the same technology. Just take a look at this diagram from the Motorsport Story YouTube channel, and how pneumatic valves work is actually pretty simple. Instead of a traditional spring, the camshaft presses the valve against a chamber of pressurized nitrogen, which acts just like a spring. However, the difference is that unlike a regular spring, which doesn't provide additional resistance when compressed harder, a pneumatic spring's resistance increases as the valve is hit harder. This means it offers better control over the valves. And this pneumatic system is key for getting F1 engines up to 20,000 RPM, allowing them to open and close the valves incredibly fast without smashing the valves to pieces. Well, most of the time anyway. Okay, so what about turbos, or maybe even a supercharger? Well, it's safe to say our engine expert likes turbos.
I like turbos. I mean, superchargers are cool, they make cool whining noises, but for the given weight and packaging and power you get from it, the power density you get from a turbo, you're just not going to pick up in a supercharger. And naturally aspirated, for the given, again, aero package and everything that goes along with it, it's going to be so much smaller and lighter to run a turbocharged car.
First turbocharged engine in Formula One dates back to 1977, and it was Renault again who pioneered it in the development of the RS01, a 1.5-litre V6. Initially, these engines were not very reliable, but did offer a massive power advantage when they worked. And in our case, there are a few solid reasons that we like turbos. First, of course, they boost power. I don't need to tell you how they work, but basically the more air that you force into the engine means that you can add more fuel, and so the bang is bigger. And if we're looking at the entirety of the car over a race distance, turbocharged engines are more fuel efficient too, meaning that the fuel tanks can be smaller and the car can be lighter. But exactly how much extra power would a turboed engine produce compared to a normally aspirated engine?
A rough rule of thumb with, of course, differences in efficiencies and small things. Roughly, by putting a turbocharger on for each atmosphere you add in terms of boost, you gain that entire displacement.
So that means, for example, if we had a 2-litre displacement and we added an extra atmosphere of boost, so 14.7 PSI, you'd effectively have the same air going into the engine as a 4-litre. And with more air going in, you can add more fuel. And again, get a bigger bang. Okay, but how much more power does it actually create? Well, if we go back to the end of the era in F1, when both normally aspirated and turbocharged cars were allowed, with 1985 being the final year of turbos with unlimited boost, you'll notice a big difference. That year, the teams were allowed a 1.5-litre engine with a turbo or a 3-litre engine without. The championship winning car was the McLaren Tag, which had a 1.5-litre V6 that produced about 850 horsepower in race setup and a massive 960 horsepower in qualifying. And the best placed non-turbo car was the Tyrrell Ford. And actually, that Ford Cosworth engine was only used for half the season. Anyway, the DFY was a 3-litre V8 that only produced about 520 horsepower. And while it didn't suffer from turbo lag, the forced induction engines more than made up for it once they were in a straight line. So yes, we are going to have a turbo. But what about hybrids? What about electrical power? Is it worth carrying the extra weight of a battery around for the extra power and instant torque? In F1, we've seen the MGUH and the MGUK. They're difficult to understand acronyms, but basically they soak up the energy that would otherwise be lost as mainly heat. This is the MGUH, and although it's being banned from 2026, we'd still like to use it in our no-rules car. The MGUH means motor generator unit dash heat. It's connected directly to the turbocharger shaft and has two roles. It can both generate power and deploy power. The MGUH takes the heat energy from the car's exhaust gases that powers the turbo and otherwise would just float away into the air, and turns that into electrical energy. It gets stored in the car's battery, ready for use. Then, when it's finally ready to be used, it acts as a motor. It spins the turbo's compressor, and it uses that energy to give the turbocharger a quick boost. It spins the turbo's compressor faster than it would just on the exhaust gases alone. And Micah likes this technology.
This is where you might still leave a little bit of hybrid in the system. If you're going to have turbos, you could have a really big turbo, but it's going to be super laggy. So you would, in my mind, I'd still want to keep an MGUH on it.
And what about the MGUK, the motor generator unit dash kinetic? This is basically how a Formula E car is so efficient. This is the part that captures the kinetic energy when the driver hits the brakes. It then stores the energy, and then in an F1 car, adds the power to the crankshaft when the driver accelerates. But Micah doesn't think that we'll need it.
And in my case, I would probably take the hybrid way, because you wouldn't need it for actual transmissive power, because you'd have all the displacement you want.
Basically, we'll have more than enough power from the internal combustion engine, so we're better off saving the weight of a larger battery. Remember, adding lightness is key. And talking of adding lightness, are there any crazy materials we could use that are currently banned in F1?
You know, I would look at, I didn't reintroduce metal matrix composites, MMC pistons, as they used to be known in the Formula One world before they got banned. Really strong, high thermal, really good thermal properties.
These materials were actually used in F1 from 2004, but now are mostly banned. In an MMC, you have a metal like aluminium or titanium, which forms the base of the material. But instead of being pure metal, it's reinforced with particles or fibers of another material, often ceramics like silicon carbide or boron carbide. These ceramic particles are incredibly strong and hard, which means they can reinforce the metal and make it much tougher and more resistant to wear and heat. And that means that the MMC parts can be stronger, stiffer, lighter, and can handle heat better. All of which are incredibly important if we're trying to get our engine to rev as high as possible. So, how much faster would this engine be? How much more power could it have? Well, I'm sorry to say that with all these things, it's incredibly difficult to know. Without any proper calculation, Micah didn't want to put an actual figure on it, but he basically said that it would be more power than any F1 car with its current grip would be able to handle. The point is that it actually wouldn't be that difficult to make an engine with 2, 3 or 4,000 horsepower. But what's the point if you can't put that power into the circuit, and the driver is just wheel spinning from corner to corner in every gear? I spoke to an F1 aerodynamicist about what he'd design if F1 had no aero rules. You can see that just here. Thank you for watching, and I'll see you next time.